Got a lot to get into. Dr. Milt Louder at 7:25 this morning. Let's get Nick and Anderson up first in this hour. Pratt Injury Lawyer phone lines. Good morning, Nick. Thanks for hanging through the break, man. How you doing?
Doing well. I've got a so if you want to take Drake to a South Carolina football game, all you do is take him to the toilet and just flush it and say, that's South Carolina football.
Plus, they got the doo-doo ice down there. I don't want to drink out of the doo-doo ice. That ain't good. Can't do that, man.
Either you could take him to a graveyard and say, this is all the coaches' careers they have killed over the years.
Yeah, graveyard. It was bad for a long time. If you think about it, who's left South Carolina? Let's look at that list. Who's left South Carolina and gone on to a better job or retired there? Look at the list of South Carolina football coaches. It hadn't been.
I think it's a pretty short list.
Yeah. Yeah, just taken by a graveyard, huh?
I was going to tell you, I don't know if you heard a story over the weekend. There's a Major League Baseball player that played for St. Louis. His first day up in the majors, he hit three home runs.
Yeah, Baez.
First day up.
First time in Major League Baseball history, first game up, three home runs. But at that point in time, you got to say to yourself, not only, hey, great job by Baez, but also like for the GM, what took you so long to call the guy up? The guy was ready, He was ready to go.
What makes it even better is his dad died, I think, 2 years ago. So he's kind of a sweet moment for him to have that moment.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Hit three home runs and have that grave moment first day up.
But yeah.
That's all I had to say. And I hope Clemson can beat LSU.
Yeah, thank you, Nick. I appreciate the phone call. I think it'll be closer than people think. I don't know if Clemson can win. Shane Beamer could have left to go to Virginia Tech. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe they were talking with James Franklin instead and had that done. You'd rather have James Franklin than Shane Beamer. Mike Bobo was an interim, and he's still coaching, but not as a head coach. Will Muschamp is still coaching, but not as a head coach. Sean Elliott's still coaching back at South Carolina as a head coach. Spurrier's not coaching anymore. Holt's not coaching anymore. Brad Scott coached afterwards, but not as a head coach. Sparky Woods, that was his last head coaching job. I think, did Sparky Woods coach anywhere as a head coach after South Carolina? VMI! I forgot about that. Sparky Woods went 17-62 at VMI afterwards. So that was not the graveyard for Sparky Woods. Joe Morrison passed away. Richard Bell didn't coach anywhere else. Jim Carlin, your guy, didn't coach anywhere else. Was that Dietzel's last stop? Yeah, that was his last coaching stop with South Carolina.
And even with Sparky Woods, VMI, I mean, that's are they FCS? Or were they Division II at the time? For me, I wouldn't even count that. Because it drives the narrative.
Warren Bass went on to coach the Montreal Beavers.
Okay.
After that's the case, so that's one in there. The last guy that went on to get, let's see, John D. McMillan coached Erskine after South, and he coached the Citadel after South Carolina. No, that was in baseball. That was in baseball. I'm sorry. In football, he went on to coach the Citadel as a head coach. So you got two basic Southern conferences in there. Let's see if William Newton coached Guilford afterwards. No one has left South Carolina. Now, and what we can do is who retired at South Carolina, who like went out on top at South Carolina. That didn't happen either, but James Moran coached Niagara in 46 through 48 at South Carolina.
So I apologize. I said it's a very short list.
Rex Enright, that was his last head coaching job.
It's not a list at all.
It's not a list.
Do we have one?
Don McAllister coached Norwich. No, he coached Norwich as a head coach afterwards.
Norwich, the championship English football team?
No. Billy Lavelle coached Emory and Henry and Newberry after that.
The law firm?
Emory, Henry, and Newberry. Harry Lightsey, that was his last head coaching job back in 1927. Branch Bocock coached the Gamecocks. And he went on to coach at William & Mary afterwards, the law firm. Sol Metzger, after he left South Carolina, that was his last job. Man, I didn't realize this. Frank Dobson. Now, Frank Dobson went on to be the head coach at Maryland later. So you got to go back to 1936. The last time that anybody coached after South Carolina as a head coach at a major school.
So the list is one.
Yes. 1936.
Wow. Whew. All right. Hey.
Spurrier retired. Well, no, Spurrier quit. Now, that didn't end good there. When's the last time it ended good for South Carolina coach? Holtz didn't. That didn't end great. Right?
It didn't end great, but.
Remember Skip? I mean, he demoted Skip and all that. He was
79 this last year.
His last 3 years, he was 5-7, 5-7, 6-5. That didn't end good.
That's pretty good.
Hey, look, to be fair, though, at most places, it doesn't end good. Joe Morrison was the best, but you know, Joe Morrison passed away. Now, they had some steroid scandals in there, too, though. But his last two seasons, he was 8-4. So, that's, you know, pretty good. But it just hadn't been very good there. You going to do the same thing for Clemson, though?
You know what? I think we have to. The main one that comes to mind is Danny Ford.
Who went on to coach Arkansas.
Uh-huh. How did he do at Arkansas? They had two good seasons and then fell off? Is that right?
Not great. He won the SEC West 1 year. Mm-hmm. In 95. He went 6-4-1, 4-7, 8-5, 4-7, 4-7. He didn't win there. Tommy Bowden hadn't coached since. Tommy West, after he coached Clemson, he was head coach at Memphis. That's not a major one. And went 49-61 at Memphis. Ken Hatfield, after he coached Clemson, he went to coach Rice. And it went not great at Rice, 55-78-1. But at least, hey, these guys are getting other jobs, but not major jobs. Danny Ford did. Charlie Pell did. He left Clemson to go to Florida and had success there. Red Parker, after Clemson, coached at Delta State as a head coach. Hootie Ingram got into administration, so he didn't coach after that. Coach Howard certainly didn't. Now, Jess Neely coached Rice. And is a powerhouse. He coached Rice for 26 years, and they were a powerhouse there. And Josh Cody, big man, Josh Cody, coached at Florida and at Temple. So Clemson had a little more success, in other words, with guys that left there. Obviously, John Heisman left Clemson and coached in his post-Clemson days, just from a historical standpoint, head coach at Georgia Tech, Penn, Washington, Jefferson, and Rice in football. And was also head coach of basketball and baseball at some places, too. You know, Coach Heisman was head coach in baseball at Clemson and at Georgia Tech. How about that? But anyway, to Nick's point, yeah, there's some graveyard in there to Nick's point.
That's a lot of in-depth analysis on the graveyard part. Now let's do the toilet bowl part. There was mention of doo-doo ice. Do you want to get into that?
Yeah, that's where they had the ice that smelled so bad. That wasn't good. You know, you didn't want that.
It's breakfast time. Let's.
Yeah. You don't want that. But yeah, it's not great. Texas said, do they give them credit for Sean Elliott, who coached them one game or two games, and then coached at Georgia State, I believe. Yes, that's a good point. That's a very good point. I missed that one. He did coach down at Georgia State. So I completely dropped the ball on that one. Not a major deal, but Sean Elliott did coach at Georgia State. You know, what's weird there is the whole time he was coaching at Georgia State, they lived, his family lived in Columbia. came back to it. At Georgia State, he was 41-44. But they won, when he was there, they won four bowl games. They won the Cure Bowl, the Lending Tree Bowl, the Camellia Bowl, and the famous Idaho Potato Bowl. Camilla Bowl. Camellia? Camellia.
I mean, four bowl game wins in 7 years at Georgia State? That's,
yeah,
that's pretty good.
Now, to I'll be fair, the South Carolina thing didn't go so well. Because that's where he lost to the Citadel. And that wasn't good. Spurrier got out. Hey, he coached the last four games there. One, two, three, four. Spurrier got out after the tennis. I mean, after the A&M game. So Spurrier left. Took his toys and went home. And I still think if you're South Carolina, still think you ding Spurrier a little bit for that. A, fall asleep at the wheel. And B, quitting in the middle of a season. Spurrier, we're going to sit around and watch that. But then you do have to say that it was disastrous after that. They played hard and lost a close-fought game at Tennessee. They lost to Florida, who was ranked 11th at the time. And they lost to Clemson. They played pretty well against Clemson. They were fired up against Clemson there. But they did lose to the Citadel. So he was South Carolina. Let me see if I'm right with saying that. He was 1-5. No. So I'll take that back. It wasn't the A&M game. He quit after the LSU loss down in Baton Rouge. And Sean Elliott did beat Vanderbilt that year.
Did you say he lost to the Citadel?
Yes. Yes.
We lost. I know we lost, Brian. Yes. It's the Citadel.
I forgot about that cat. Oh, totally forgot about that one. I've seen Furman beat. I've seen Citadel beat Cyclone twice, right? I think I'm right by saying that. Look that series up. We're going to have Dr. Milt Louder coming up. And looking forward to that. If you have I tell you, let's do this too. Because he likes this. If you have sports psychology questions or business or personal psychology, not personal psychology, but performance psychology. How about that? Performance psychology questions. Let's get into that and let's ask Dr. Louder. So you can text that into the Adams Covering text line, 654-ROAR, 654-7627. Matter of fact, I was dating my wife when she lived in Charleston, and we went to the Clemson Citadel baseball game. And this is the year after Citadel beat South Carolina football. So this is the spring of 2016. Is that right? And they were playing, there was their season tickets. They were trying to push season tickets for football at their baseball game. And they played highlights of the South Carolina win in Columbia.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah. How about that? And Clemson, by the way, and Clemson fans loved it in the baseball park that night. All right, short break. We'll come back. We'll get with a moment with Milt, Dr. Milt Louder, our sports and performance psychologist, right after this. X.com. A moment with Milt, our sports and performance psychologist from Amplos.com. Good morning, Dr. Louder. How you doing this morning?
Great, Mickey. How are you guys?
I'm fantastic. You mentioned this to me off the air a few weeks ago. Hey, let's do a segment where we take some text messages, and we've already got a couple flying in. I'll invite folks to text in now. Adams and Curry, text line 654-ROAR. If you have sports or performance psychology questions for the good doctor. And during the break, we got a couple of really interesting ones in. And I want to jump into it. This you're gonna love this one, Doc, here. Question for the doctor, and it's kind of embarrassing, but here it goes. I have a huge anxiety about moving up in my career and even in my hobbies. The thought of taking a bunch of extra responsibilities makes me extremely anxious to the point where I had to take meds. What can I do to help this? And I've been offered several positions over the years I never took due to this, and I hate to admit it. But I do know this, Doc. A problem shared is a problem halved, and I do know you're going to have some good advice to maybe help with this debilitating anxiety that he's suffering through.
Look at you, Mickey. I'm dropping some Abraham Lincoln on us.
Yes.
I like it.
Yes.
To me, I think, again, shame, you know, being able to talk about it and disclose it and just admit to yourself, hey, I got extreme anxiety about this, and labeling it as an anxiety and not labeling yourself think that's a big piece. But I think oftentimes, Mickey, it's hard to act inconsistent with your own identity, with your own self-image. And so for whatever reason, this listener does not believe he has what it takes or she has what it takes to move up to the next level or in their hobbies. And so doing something that is uncomfortable, stretching beyond their comfort zone, we got to make sure we interpret the emotions correctly. So that anxiety, adrenaline, all that runs through our body when we're nervous, when we're anxious, when we're excited. But I think the advice I would give is make sure we paint a picture of who he can be and who he wants to be, and seeing himself performing at a great level, whether that's with hobbies or whether that's at work. I would also recommend some strategies around quieting the mind. What are the thoughts that are habitually engaging his mind? And what evidence does he have to support those thoughts, such as, I don't have what it takes, I'm not good enough, I can't do that, I need to, but I can't. There's nothing more stressful or anxiety-inducing than thinking you have to do something and feeling like you can't. And then just some relaxation techniques. We know when the body is in a relaxed state, it's hard to be anxious and relaxed at the same time. And so some breathing to learn how to calm that sympathetic nervous system that he's activated over his life when he's faced with new and different circumstances.
Sorry, Doc. I'm not going to mention phone numbers on these just in case. I don't want to incriminate anybody. But first-time texter here, and she says, my husband and I have an 8-year-old son that plays multiple sports. Question for Dr. Louder. What can we say to him after a bad game or practice that builds resilience without making him feel like he has to perform for us? How can we help him handle mistakes, frustration, or losing?
Oh, that's such a challenging one because I love the competitive spirit. Mickey, I think I told you I dropped my youngest girl off last week, and we did a podcast last week, and she talked about her performance, that even though she knew we reinforced effort and positive attitude and hustle and competitive spirit, that her interpretation when she performed poorly, even though it was maybe due to those things, that she was still letting us down. That we were still disappointed in her and not her behavior. And so I think as parents, we always have to be mindful that the words we speak and our body language says so much about what we believe is important. And so the last part of that text around how do we encourage him, I think you got to create a rhythm and a habit of evaluation, not criticism, after every game. And so get in that habit and that rhythm. First off, how does he want to show up? Why is he playing the game? What does it look like if he's having fun on the field or on the court? And then after the game, you know, giving him some time to process whether it goes good or whether it goes bad, you can create a rhythm of evaluation on the ride home or once you get home. What went well? What didn't go well? What'd you learn? What was fun about today's game? And try to model the behavior that you want and shape the behavior that you want. And then there's a time and a place to discipline the behavior that you don't want in terms of the reaction, the negativity. There's a way to call that out, that you're calling out the behavior and not calling out the child.
On the opposite end of that, I'll add to that question because, you know, I heard Coach Sweeney talk about it last week on a social media post where it was, we're built for the climb, we're not built to stand on the mountaintop. I'll ask you, how about on those rides home where it goes great and you hit the game-winning home run and you're not, because you don't want to be tied all the way to results all the time, and you talk about the growth mindset of that, but how about handling success after that great practice or that great game? How much do you want to build on that and how much do you want to ground off of that?
Well, that's even more important, Mickey, to reinforce the effort and the process. See, when times are good, if you tell your child when he hits a home run how awesome he is and how great he is and he's great and that's so much fun, then what you're really enforcing that you really care about is his achievement and not his effort and not the process. And so when you care more about outcomes than the process, you can't control the outcomes because what the young mind interprets, well, you love me and are proud of me when I do really well. Even though you don't say this, what's the interpretation when I don't do well? And so we almost reinforce that achievement and achieving your goals and success and the way the world defines it is what's most important. So it's just as important to reinforce maybe more so when things go really well, and you can tie it back to the things within their control. I think that's a great point, Mickey.
I was talking to a former client of yours the other day. Matter of fact, I sent you a there was an old, you know, from old letterhead. I don't know if you recognize what year that old letterhead came from. I texted that this weekend.
I think it was Louder Group or Synergy Group. I think that was Synergy Group became 2016, so it was circa around then.
Yeah, yeah. But one of the things that and the parents talked about is how in your kids as they get older is letting them learn from their mistakes, but how hard it is as a parent to watch your kid fail, knowing they need to fail, knowing they need to have adversity, knowing that there's growth opportunities from that, and you want to help them, but sometimes it's hard to do. Just sit there and watch them fail and get off of it. I'll let you talk about that and address that of how we do that as parents.
Well, again, good insight from my 18-year-old daughter that I'm really good professionally, Mickey, at being present in someone else's pain, but as a parent, you feel like you got to take away the pain.
Yeah.
And that's the most limiting factor, I think, of being human, is not being able to take away someone else's pain. But learning at even a young age to let them suffer in their pain, to let them learn from it, to see how they respond to adversity, that's what grit, that's what resilience, that's what the world requires. And so giving them opportunities to learn and not criticizing the coach or not criticizing the teacher or not condemning the other team, and letting them learn to take ownership of and experience the highs and the lows, because how they respond to success and how they respond to adversity will be a key predictor to the rest of their life and the quality of their life.
Here's one from a parent of a young child that has anxiety about going to class, going to sporting events. How do you walk a 5 or 6-year-old through that? That's an interesting concept. Like, you do see it a lot of times, shyness, and you see it in social type situations or athletic type situations. You see it a lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, the young brain at 5 and 6 is not going to be able to handle cognitive psychology too much. They aren't the most rational, although they have some great insight. So it's more of behavioral modification. And so, you know, I remember trying to teach my kids to breathe and quiet that body at a young age. And then with some little encouragement, there's where, as a parent, you slowly challenge them to new experiences. You know, not the old school, throw them in the deep end and see if they can swim. You walk them out in the shallow end. You give them opportunities to practice mastery, to learn how to handle that anxiety. And then you're able to, again, model that behavior. You know, Clarence Kellen had that great quote, "My parents did not tell me how to live. He lived, and I learned by watching him." And sometimes as parents, we can reinforce the anxiety by talking about it, by giving into it, by, this is going to be really hard, and this is going to be really difficult, and this is going to be so challenging, but I think you can do it. Sometimes less is more, and there are behavioral opportunities, experiential conditioning, where the child gets to practice some of these activities in a safe environment. Because they have to learn they have what it takes. It's not enough for you to tell them as parents. They have to be able to shape and experience it. And obviously you're doing that at different developmental stages. You know, the activities you engage in at 5 to help calm anxiety will be somewhat different than maybe what you do at 15 or 25.
All right, I'm going to summarize this is a personal text on my personal line here. I'm going to summarize this for a parent and a friend of mine. And I think this gets back to, maybe I'm wrong on this, Doc. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the difference in self-esteem and self-efficacy. And I know for a fact that they've got 3 kids here. But anyway, one of their kids, very, very self-confident, almost overconfident, thinking that he's the best at everything he does, even though he's not. But do you want to reward that, or do you bring attention to that? Well, I've had this conversation with him before, but, like, I mean, my son thinks he's great at everything, and sometimes he's not, but How do you go about that?
Well, I don't know what age we're talking about here, Mickey, but I think life will – that obviously is early makings of a fixed mindset, that it's always in constant comparison to others. And so believing you have what it takes and believing that you're the best and believing that you can do that, like, that's key. But this seems to be almost trying to talk themselves into that in a comparison that they are the greatest ever. So what age? Do you know what age we're talking about here?
I'm thinking 5 to 6 to 7. Oh. I think I know what child he's talking about. 5 to 6 to 7 in that range. 6 to 7.
Yeah. Yes. I don't think you got to worry about that too much at 5 or 6 or 7. I mean, those young children dream and they're following their heroes and they're seeing their models. Now, if it becomes a behavior that affects their relationships with others, affects their ability to be coached, affects their ability to work, like they aren't willing to do anything to get any better, they're just talking about how great they are, then I think you got to start paying attention. But at 5 or 6 or 7, I think you can take that with a grain of salt. And again, those are just constant opportunities to remind them and reward them for the things that really matter about work. I mean, that's what the research really says. Our job as parents and the young development of athletes and children is positivity and having fun and different experiences and learning from quote unquote success and learning from quote unquote failure. That's what really important. Learning how to get along with others, learning how to take feedback. Those are why, that's why sports are so important.
And I'm not from my personal standpoint through it all, that whatever it is today, it won't be that way tomorrow. There's little minds and little personalities are developing, and it's always there's phases and there's stages in there. But like for my oldest one now, man, he's like whatever he's doing today, he won't be doing in 2 weeks or a month. It's just so many little facets of their personalities that are kind of forming their way through.
And I think that's what being present as parents is. You kind of have your finger on the pulse and you try to meet them where they are and give them some skills and strategies. And I think, you know, parenting matters, discipline matters, accountability matters, and what that looks like in everyone's home, they have to figure out for themselves. But I think that's part of the problem with self-esteem. We try to minimize our children's suffering. We try to minimize them facing consequences. We try to minimize and shield them from the truth. And we tell them how great they are. And then they're surprised and shocked when they realize there's really nothing special about them.
We could do 10 segments on that. I love this stuff. I love this segment. Tell me about Amplos.com. Tell me what you guys are doing over there. And by the way, I love the podcast with your daughter. Y'all did a good job with her. Your wife did a great job with her. Nah, she was fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of failures on that podcast and what not to do as a dad, but I think that's why we do it, Mickey. And just so grateful for you and your listeners to say, hey, we want to help you be better at work and we want you to help you be better at sports, but really to be better at the things that matter for the people that matter. And so for your listeners to care enough and text the questions, I'm just grateful for the opportunity. And, you know, that's really what continues to inspire us at Amplos as our world continues to change. We get really inspired by people that want to be better and pursue better. And we just look for opportunities to try to be relevant in people's life and encouraging in people's life.
Great stuff. Always enjoy it. Amplos.com. Let's get on the podcast. Let's learn more about the programs that they have and see if they can help the good folks out. Dr. Lott, always appreciate it, buddy. Can't wait to visit you the next week.
Me too. Thanks, Mickey.
All right, buddy. Dr. Milt Lauder, Amplos.com. We'll take a break. Open phone lines for the rest of the show, including I have a salaries segment and I have a tempo segment. College football trends. We'll give you both of that right after this.
The Roar's 2026 College Football Kickoff Show will be live from Southern Weaving Food Hall in Easley. August 20.
What are the keys to Paul McCartney's longevity? Obviously, his talent. But I've heard this one time, and this is, I think, one of the coolest aspects. And one of the things we can learn the most from when it comes to the Beatles and about life and about sports and everything else. And it's the guy that kind of founded the Beatles. Somebody can tell me his name. But he was talking about them in a documentary, and he said, you know, he was charged with finding talent or producing talent, whatever it might be, and he's seen all these acts everywhere, and he's introduced to people who are very talented musicians and songwriters or artists and all that, and that's great. He said, when it came to the Beatles, I thought that there were many, many more talented music acts out there. He said, but the key was these guys had likability. He goes, in talking to them before their shows or after their shows or hanging out with them and traveling, whatever it might be, that I just like being around them. And you think about it, like, does anybody not like Sir Paul McCartney? He's just this likable guy. And I'm telling you, this is important when in business, this is important in sports. You run across hundreds of people every single day, and a majority of them I don't want to spend 2 minutes with. But there's a lot of, when you do find those people that are just likable, you just want to be attracted to them and want to be around them. I think Paul McCartney is a great example of it. And it's interesting. And I don't know the history of who this guy founded and who he produced or what it might be, who he managed, whoever. What might have to go back and look at that. But he said it was not their music that the reason he chose to take them on or chose to promote them. It was their personalities. He just wanted to be around them. You know, I ask Phil Potter that all the time on the show about football coaches or basketball coaches. Hey, of these two guys playing on Saturday, which one would I want to come over to the house and cook out? Have him and his wife over, the kids over, whatever, cook out in the backyard barbecue. Who do I want to get in the car with and drive a couple hours with? Or who would I want to play golf with that day? Like, makes sense? You like this concept? Likeability, man. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And even, I mean, think about Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
He's probably the most likable of all of them. Least talented, worst drummer.
You think? I talked to Larry Williams about Ringo's drumming, and he said a lot of times it's simplicity, because he didn't overdo it. Sometimes drummers overdo it. But Ringo was talented.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm now, making the joke about.
Yeah, not as talented as Paul, John, or George, but talented, man. Talented. But likable guy. I think that's important. It's really important in sports, too. You know who's not likable right now? This Marte, this Ketel Marte, the D-backs guy. You got to show up for work, man. You got to show up for work. If you don't show up for work, then and they're paying you millions of dollars to do it. George Martin, by the way, was the guy's name. The guy that found the Beatles. That is right. I knew that. Likeability. Now, you have to produce Bernie Taupin. I'm getting that one, too. You got to produce. You can't just be just likable and sit around and do nothing. In football, you got to win. In basketball, baseball, you got to win. In hockey and soccer and golf, you got to win some, too. You got to produce some records out there. But there's a lot of talented people. The point was, whenever you get likability, you tend to... You have a longer leash. Talk about it all the time with coaches. If a guy's a turd sandwich, the leash is shorter. Texas said Jaden Daniels' likability. Yeah, look, I'll be honest with you. Jaden Daniels better be really, really good at quarterback now. He's used up all his likability.
Didn't like him, didn't hate him until 5 days ago, and Now it's so easy to hate him.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, let me get to this point here. So Bill Connelly, ESPN writer, this was from a couple days ago. Him and Adam Rittenberg talked about trends in college football and things we'll see in 2026. And one of them, and this is very important, and I hit on this last year. One of them is tempo. And let me read part of the article here. He goes, Ohio State lined up for Miami's 22-yard line, poised to answer Hurricane's first score with its own in the quarterfinal matchup, the Cotton Bowl. A 59-yard pass to Jeremiah Smith, the longest against an FBS opponent all season, moved Ohio State into the red zone. Even after a sack, the Buckeyes were well within scoring range, but Miami's Keontae Scott stepped in front of a Julian Sands swing pass and raced 72 yards to the other end zone. The Buckeyes suddenly trailed 14-0, a significant deficit, but not insurmountable one, nearly 12 minutes remaining in the first half. High State's coming, averaging 3.5 points per drive, which ranked fifth in college football. College football's history has been rich with furious comebacks, but the Buckeyes seemed capable of delivering another one. As the game unfolded, though, Ohio State rally mission grew bleaker. The game flow changed in college football is becoming clear. The Buckeyes logged these three more possessions before halftime, the final two beginning inside their own 10-yard line. The only three drives they had in the second half, taking over 55 seconds left to go and trailing by 10. The point, and they scored two touchdowns, but the point is they consumed 11 minutes and 14 seconds off the clock in the process. And Miami scored just 10 points after the pick six, but ended up with 5 minutes on each of the two scoring drives and ate up 9 minutes and 37 seconds there of three non-possession scoring things. The point is that teams are possessing the football longer and going at a much slower pace. Clock changes, longer seasons, slower offensive tempo, and a surprising factor, fourth down success. Teams are going for it more on fourth down, which means they're possessing it longer in individual drives, and it's producing fewer offensive plays because of the pace. For instance, in 2015, we ran a play every 25.1 seconds in 2015 and 16, and that has gone up for the most part every year. Last year, it was almost 27 seconds per play. And now you run, in other words, that's two plays per minute, basically. And now you're talking about 120 plays rather than, well, for instance, offensive plays per game went from 71.5 down to 67. That's almost five less plays per game. Drives per game or points per drive have gone up, but points per game have gone down. We've got fewer drives, and again, you're not punting as much. But we went from 27.8 points per game down to 26.2 points per game. We're having fewer drives. Teams are trying to keep the ball longer. Ohio State was a great example of this. I'm going to give you this in the next hour. But Ohio State, one of their keys to the success, and Alabama as well last year. Remember we talked about Alabama, how slow they go. Ohio State was one of the slowest teams in the country last year. You would think that they'd have the talent advantage. They want to go faster and have more plays. It's like this. I think this is where Rondé messes up a little bit. If we're better than you, the more plays we run, the more chances we can to expose that. And if we're deeper than you, the more plays we can run to expose that as well. But teams have gone the other way, and teams are basically playing NFL football now. Slow it down, grind it out, get in the fourth quarter, possess the football, keep your defense on the sidelines. And going for it on fourth down. I'll give you the fourth down stuff later as well, but it's an interesting trend in college football. It was, and I'll give you the Ohio State. Up until the Indiana game, I think it was, and Indiana does it well. Time of possession used to not matter when you're scoring on big plays and long touchdown passes and long touchdown runs. Time of possession meant nothing 10 years ago. Now it means a lot. So I'll give you that trend when we come back. Also, phone calls and text messages. But Bill Connelly's hit on something. With Will, Mickey, hour number two when you come back after this.